I walked to the beach and I stayed at the beach and wouldn't leave the beach until I had a reason to live. And every night I'd do the same routine before sunset. I'd jump in the water and I would swim out and hope that a shark would eat me. And I was like, please, shark, come eat me at night. And I would swim out there for like an hour. And then as the weeks went on, I started saying, if I leave this effing beach, I'm going to be a son of a bitch and I'm never going to quit. And literally, when I left that beach, I was really on a mission. And I felt like I needed the story to get told. The whole entrepreneurial journey was crafted, and all most things were set in motion for what I was about to go through when I walked off that beach.
Welcome to the Seven Hats Podcast. My name is Yuval Selig, and I've been on the entrepreneurial roller coaster for over 20 years. I've experienced it all throughout my journey: the grind, burnout, failure, and ultimately, success. The turning point for me was realizing that building a successful company is meaningless if you neglect the other significant areas of your life. So today, I'm inviting you to join me on an adventure through those seven areas, what I call the seven hats. Every week, my guests and I will drop valuable insights and pearls of wisdom, helping, motivating, and inspiring you to get your seven hats in order and deliver real impact with meaning. So let's get going. Welcome, Seven Hatters. Today, get ready to dive into the captivating journey of Richard Laver, an audacious entrepreneur and branding trailblazer, as we delve into hats 1, 3, and 4, the soul, the servant, and the entrepreneur. Join us as we peel back the layers of Richard's extraordinary voyage from a determined innovator to a disruptor in the beverage industry. Richard's upbringing was one of resilience, shaped by his early experiences and relentless pursuit of innovation. Encouraged by his family to think outside the box, Richard's entrepreneurial spirit took flight, leading him to embark on his first venture at a young age of 12. And despite the challenges inherent in the entrepreneurial world, Richard's steadfast determination and acute understanding of consumer needs propelled him forward. However, Richard's journey was marked by a pivotal moment when he survived a plane crash. That's right, a harrowing experience that instilled in him a profound appreciation for life and an unwavering drive to make an impact. Yet, Richard's path was not without its obstacles. From navigating the complexities of the CPG beverage industry to challenging industry norms, each hurdle became a stepping stone towards greater success. His story is a testament to perseverance, adaptability, and the unwavering pursuit of his vision. And today, as the founder of Lucky Fuck, Richard has revolutionized the energy drink industry, carving out a unique space in a crowded market. Beyond his business accomplishments, Richard is committed to inspiring others, sharing his expertise, and mentoring aspiring entrepreneurs. So if you're ready for a dose of resilience and innovation, eager to learn from a seasoned entrepreneur, or fascinated by the evolution of the beverage market, join me in extending a warm welcome to Richard on the Seven Hats. Richard, welcome to the Seven Hats.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting.
Of course. You know, it's a true honor to have you, especially since your impact actually resonates far and wide in the CPG entrepreneurial world, where I'm from. You're my favorite kind of entrepreneur, which we'll dive into in our conversation. You're a serial entrepreneur with a heart. You're not only pioneered the plant-based nutrition revolution with Kate Farms, but also shaken up the energy drink, the market with, you know, Lucky Beverages. But before we delve into the nuances of your business and the lessons that you've learned along the way, the Seven Hatters, as we call them, I'm sure are eager to hear about your personal path to entrepreneurship. So, Richard, let's turn back the pages to where it all began. Where were you born and how was your childhood like?
Yeah, so I was born in outback town in Australia called Rockhampton, and born into a sports family. My grandfather developed a sports store and started out as a fisherman's store. And cricket, which is a very popular sport in India and Australia, yep, across. And he started to get into tennis a little bit and built a tennis court at his house. And my father was national champion, and the family really started to move from different types of sports into tennis. And then my grandfather's brother's son was Rod Laver, and he ended up being an Australian guy that wasn't very good when he first started, but ended up being number one in the world in tennis. And then when he won the Grand Slam, which is sort of all four majors in 1 year, he's the only person to do it twice. And so considered before Federer probably the best player ever. So he sponsored my father. We came from a very modest family in the Outback, and he sponsored him to come to Florida. So it would have been like today, it would be like a Roger. There was no money in tennis back then. You win a Grand Slam and it was like $10,000, $5,000. So there was no wealthy, really, I would say basketball or football players. These guys were not making the kind of money we think about today. But there was opportunity in America. And so my father came to the United States and started a little modest tennis resort in South Florida. And that's where I grew up. And it ended up becoming, my father was a major entrepreneur, charisma guy, and good storyteller. And he ended up building this club. It started out with five tennis courts, one building, some condos, and it ended up becoming this massive resort. But before he died, so I came there when I was 2 years old to Florida. Before he died, he did deals on a handshake. And in Australian Outback, you did deals like that. Like you did big deals like that. So my father came to America doing deals like that. And he ended up getting squeezed out. And so when he died in a plane crash that I was in, he ended up broke. So it was kind of crazy having that kind of life trajectory and story. And that's what happened to him.
So you mentioned, and I've done a little research, but you mentioned a plane crash. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. I know a lot of people ask you, but I'm curious to get a little more detail. So you were in the plane with him?
Yeah. So I grew up down in South Florida. I'm on the grounds, and my father's a busy guy, Australian, in a million directions as an entrepreneur. And I grew up in a bar basically, and at Laver's. And so my father would sit at the bar. He was really well known. And so that was my environment. Wasn't the best family life. Seemed like a resort would be a great place for a kid to grow up, but my mother and father split up. My mother didn't like the lifestyle of my father. He just wanted to win and build this thing. This was his life. And so towards the end of his life in 1985, I was 12, and I was emerging as a left-hander like Rod, that I was going to be. I just started to show this potential out of nowhere and started to win a lot of tournaments. And my father decided that he was losing the battle of which your podcast is about, is he was trying to win and he was losing and he was wondering what his life was all about. And he started to spend time with me. And I was already acting out as a child. And so he wanted to take me to these tennis tournaments. And so I qualified for the national tournament in San Diego. And I had a dream the night before. And I told my father, I said, I'm not going on that plane. I don't think it's going to make it. And so I had dinner with my mother. And I told her this dream I was having, that the plane was going to crash. So she looked across at me. She said, it's one in a million. It's crazy. We've flown you to Wimbledon. We've done things like this. You've never been scared to fly. And I said, Mom, we're not going to make it. And so I tried to, in Australia, there's two things you can't do. And this really worked in my business career. It's not, my father always said, don't care about if you're liked or loved. None of that means anything. What matters is that you're honorable with money and that you know, where we come from, we don't do any of that stuff. And so my father just saw that I was losing my temper, but not wanting to get on the plane. That was another thing, temperament. So he said, you're not going onto the tournament. So I had this celebration in my bedroom privately. And I'm like, yes, I'm not going on the plane. He grabbed my rackets the last second and said, we're going to this tournament. And then I was the worst plane crash in Texas history, Delta Flight 191, 137 people died. 27 people were alive. I think within 2 years, 15 were alive. And I was the youngest child on the plane. My dad died next to me, covering me. And I'm the second person in the world that's ever been ejected out of a commercial plane. When it was on final approach, we crashed in a thunderstorm. The only time a jumbo jet's ever crashed in what's called a wind shear. And so it's a tornado. Instead of spinning around, it pushes the plane down. And we had engine stall failure. Crashed on the freeway, took out a car, and the tail broke away, and I was ejected out of the plane. And so my life, I saw my mother. I woke up from the coma a couple of days later, and she said to me, "We're going to find a reason for your purpose in life." And she said, "We're searching for your father in dental." I said, "Everyone's dead," because I knew from the pilot to me, the explosion was so bad that the only way people lived was to be torn away. And so that's how my life really started. I think at that moment, I knew, I was looking around all childhood friends that were my age, and they all had this innocence about them, and their moms were taking care of them. I was already felt like I grew up in that bar. I kind of felt like, you know, I just, my innocence was a bit lost in the fact that my dad was recognizing that, you know, he wasn't an abusive father. It's just the fact that it just was, he was in a fast growth company. And it was just, so ended up being that I went through my childhood fights, failing, anger problems, issues. And ultimately at 27, I ended up homeless on the beach. And so that's where my life on the decisions that I made on that beach is sort of the life story thing that I'm telling now is about what happened. That beach determined the next 25 years, 20 years of my life. So that's what happened.
Your dad being an entrepreneur, and we know how we are, right? Number one priority is the business a lot of times. Everything else comes second. What did you not get from your dad that you think if you would have gotten potentially, because I don't know how, you know, what that did for you, kind of having your dad die suddenly without resolving any issues that you might have had. Were there any issues that you are facing, have faced over time, where you didn't get something from him because he was an entrepreneur, but yet you couldn't resolve them?
Yeah, so there was, I'm here because of a collection of things, right? So there was this goodness inside of me. I was a kid that would cry after fighting. Like someone would pick, if I saw a kid picking on a bully picking on a helpless kid, I'd go beat him up and then I'd cry. As a kid, I was just torn with all these emotions. But inside, I would see this, I'd give half my sandwich to anybody. I was failing in school. I just needed a lot of love and attention. I was a very emotional person. I came through my brands. And I just was scared. You know, my father would come home at 9 o'clock at night into this. He was losing his business and things were going. And I wasn't getting the love. I was fearful. There was a period of my life where, before the plane crash, where, you know, there would be, I'd be home alone. I would keep a knife around because I thought someone was breaking in the house or something. It was just a lot of stuff that was happening. And it wasn't beating or anything like that. So it's this weird thing. Like on one side, my father would sit me down after he was drinking and would say, "Son, if you do this, you're a real loser." It was never about being the nicest guy, or it was never about, it was about, forget about all that stuff. It's about never stealing. You can drink, he would tell me, "Son, don't ever do drugs. Drink yourself as much as you ever want." And so my role models were like John Wayne. I remember my dad, I'd see pictures with him with John Wayne. He would teach tennis. He had all these manly, he was like, had the Australian. So I grew up thinking, and all the women wanted to be around him. So I had a feeling of what a man was. So I've had to break down that barrier for many years, because I thought what a man was John Wayne and, you know, have the drinks and the cigarettes, all the women and stuff. But the real things that are unremarkable that people don't celebrate are what makes a good man is probably being there, making sure that you overcome your demons, making sure that you admit your fault.
Yeah. So then how old were you when
your dad died? I was 27. I had lost this business deal, and I remember the smell of the bar when I left, and I broke, and I had this deal, and this guy came in and they let me set it up, and they cut me out of the deal, and I, you know, and I didn't understand business yet. And I had a, you know, I left home when I was 15 years old, didn't have a relationship with my mother. And so I sort of self-raised myself, even though I came from this famous family, I had no real allies. I'm running around the world, around Florida with a chip on my shoulder. And I walked to the beach and I stayed at the beach and wouldn't leave the beach until I had a reason to live. So I stayed there for 30 days. And grew a beard, and I would go at this restaurant next door, and I'd go have a happy hour, and I'd steal the guy. Everyone knew, because my father around the area was well known, even though he died. People knew that I was struggling, and so I'd just take the happy hour stuff. They'd let me eat the food and leave, and then every night I'd do the same routine before sunset. I'd jump in the water, and I would swim out and hope that a shark would eat me in the middle, like And it was like this thing. And I was like, please, shark, come eat me at night. And I would swim out there for like an hour. And then as the weeks went on, I started saying, if I leave this effing beach, I'm going to be a son of a bitch. And I'm never going to quit. And my story's never. And I just couldn't reconcile. But I said, man, I don't want to do this. And literally, when I left that beach, I was really on a mission. And the mission was, I didn't know what the mission was, but my life, I felt like I needed the story to get told. So the whole entrepreneurial journey was crafted, and most things were set in motion for what I was about to go through with Kate Farms and this founding and my daughter when I walked off that beach.
And you didn't go to college, or you did?
Dropout.
So pure entrepreneur, dropout, homeless, you know, with a traumatic past. Perfect entrepreneur. Okay. So my favorite entrepreneurs. All right. So how did you get from the beach to the emotional journey of developing Kate Farms in your kitchen, right? And how did that become the one in a million where it actually became a market leader?
So I had premonitions, right? And so my daughter was born, and I fell in love with this woman, and Katie was born, and another thing happens to me. And so the doctor comes in and said, Katie's got cerebral palsy. Michelle had a blood pressure that spiked called preeclampsia. It kills about 60,000 women a year. Anyways, what ended up happening was Katie's born, doctors come and tell me the bad news. I sit down with God and I said, well, what's going on? And I knew I was in the middle of a real Book of Job story that was playing out. I was like looking at the story myself at that time. And Katie's starting to struggle on Nestle and Abbott formulas. And she's at a time where they diagnosed her with a thing called failure to thrive. And failure to thrive is when a blanket term for where they don't know why they can't get you to be okay, but your body's turned on itself. It's allergic. And so I read a book called The China Study. I put the book down and I knew what was wrong with Katie. And I wrote a paper called Tree of Life, a thesis on what made my daughter sick. And so I learned that the main ingredient in Elmer's glue was casein. And casein was in 98% of the formulas from Abbott and Nestle that they were feeding globally around the world. So it hit me that I started to go to senior citizen homes and notice that I'd ask for pictures of a man that was 45 years old, and he was strapping 200 pounds. Now he's eating the same calories and he's losing weight. So I started to put two and two together in an unorthodox way. I started to see that Katie's on a 4,000 calorie a day diet. She's 15 pounds and she can't gain weight. That means there's absorption problems. That means that the body turns itself into this casein, glues the stomach almost, and turns the ability to absorb these nutrients goes away. And then they start to produce all these other symptoms. And then I noticed that a lot of the symptoms that were created, they had other products to treat those symptoms. So Kate's on 10 medications, 15 pounds, 5 years old. I decide to create a formula that was free of casein, but there was one thing missing at the time. No one had put real copious amounts of superfoods. You were making it in your shakes for the healthy people at Whole Foods, but no one was putting it in RTD quite yet, like at that level. So I took, well, at any level. So I took 32 superfoods that I felt around the world that were to heal you, put it in one drink, took away all the allergens. Within 30 days, Katie was off every medication except one. Went back to the doctors and they said, you have no background in medicine. And I said, well, it doesn't matter. Let's just do this. Bottom line is I have the evidence. Here's all the patients. They all got well. No one wanted to listen to me. So this is where I think great athletes and great entrepreneurs, a lot of them, there's always like a lucky product that like, not lucky, but because there's always like this, you know, perhaps moment where entrepreneur accidentally finds a market fit and just goes on to that. And we hear the stories and all of a sudden it's a billion in revenue overnight, et cetera. But a lot of times the great innovations come from what you said in the beginning of this podcast, people with chips on their shoulder, people that have a lot of trauma, have a lot of things, and they refuse to quit and they're angry, right? So Kate Farms is a love story, but it's really an anger story. It was about me saying, taking on everyone saying, let's go, mother effers. Let's, you know, So what ended up happening was I create this formula, everyone's getting well, no one's giving me the time of day. And I go, dude, it's right in front of your eyes. It's innovation. So I start to put it in a mason jar, send Katie back to school. She's thriving. She's gained 10 pounds. She's on her way to well. To this day, Katie's on Kate Farms. She's never been sick but one time in 10 years, right? So, but the California school board comes to me and says, you're not a doctor. You have no right to put this. And special needs people are not allowed to have unregulated food and pack it without being in packages. So I said, what are you going to do? They're going to send CCS after you, and you're going to be hit with a law. And I said, well, guess what? I'm starting a company then. That's what I'm going to do. So we started Keep Farm. And it wasn't the rest is history. I spent 160 batches, 2 years. And you never get a runway that long to do it. But I had a little bit of capital from people that believed the project was worth doing. And I was down to my last batch before Expo West. I was telling everyone that I had this great innovation, but I had nothing. And I was close, but I didn't have anything. And so I walk in a warehouse on my 86th batch or something. And I hit pay dirt, and the product was perfect, tasted perfect. It was ready. Went to Expo West. We were up for the next award, and then ran into massive problems in there. And then ultimately we made the big pivot to medical, because that's where my customers really existed. They needed it the most. The yoga moms, they were complaining that it was a high carbohydrate, high sugar product. It was at maximum, Kate Farms would have been a $50 million business, but to become the unicorn it became, we went to medical.
Wow. And so where's casein found? So for those who don't know.
Well, casein is food. It's a dairy. It's in all milk, all cheese, all products. Now, here's the thing. Look, if you're a normally healthy individual, when I say healthy, I don't mean that you're on the health kick of your lifetime and you've made this tremendous, all your blood tests are coming back perfect. I'm talking about if you're not in a wheelchair and you're not a senior citizen and you're not up against it, life and death, and you can move throughout the world, generally, you can move casein and milk through your body properly. It's the people that are in a senior citizen home, their activity's gone way down, and all they're doing is consuming mashed potatoes and protein shakes that have dairy and all these things, that this glue-like thing starts to form in your mucus. And so that mucus starts to bring on all kinds of related illness, I believe. Well, my paper. What I believe that my thesis was.
So you went to medical. I'm sure the medical community is a little harder than the yoga moms to convince. So did you face challenges convincing them that there are some benefits to your product? And if so, how did you do it? And what objections did you overcome with that?
Well, by the way, one of my biggest things of a chip on your shoulder, being a rebel, is go where there's no one playing. That's the best place to go. Be a big fish in all ponds. So what, you know, one of the things was when I was in retail, was Orgain was my main competitor. I had production issues. It can be a vicious business. And you and I will have a talk about that another time. People don't realize, like, the authentic, once billion-dollar exits and a lot of money started happening, the suits started showing up, and pilots wouldn't let you run your drinks sometimes. Like, there's vicious things that go on, no matter what, how beautiful the company and everything that everyone says they are. There's a lot of stuff. You're talking about potential growth. But what ended up happening was I had to build an organization. So if you're building something and pioneering something that's been in existence, the prior way of doing it has been in existence for 100 years, and you're up against it, then your story authenticity needs to be number one. That's what's got to come through in all of your phone calls, your ability to get. So for the 90% that say no to you, you need to get your tribe of people that are moved by your story. And one of the things I did is early on, I didn't tell the story. I was trying to be a, hey, I'm Richard and I'm selling a good plant-based shake. Once I start doing what I did with you right here and telling, I saved my daughter's life, this is what happened, eye to eye. I found my tribe and people that were willing to give me a chance. And so when we went over to medical, we found that there were a lot of young dietitians that were coming up that didn't just sign up and believe whatever the companies were saying. And they believed the stories. They were getting their information independently on social media. They were being educated in a new way. And they were also open to new ideas. Whereas I think the older guard was just like, okay, well, 1908, they said this, and 1950. and they were willing to break the rules. And so we were entering a time, I think if Kate Farms came into medical 10 years earlier, we were done. So we came in at a decent time. It wasn't quite the way it is today. Today, it's still hard to break through in medical. So I had to do three or four things very important. Number one, I had to decide that if I'm going up against the biggest companies in the world, food companies in the world with an authentic story, they're not excited for me. So I need to get a lot of capital. So if I need to get a lot of capital, I need to share the opportunity. And so to share the opportunity, I took on a lot of dilution. I took on a lot of advisors, and I took on eventually the Goldman Sachs of the world that could help me show the power of a team to be taken seriously. And then once we were able to break through and show, I think at one point in 2017, we went from 2 million to like 12 million or something like that. Then everyone took notice that this was a company that was moving rapidly, and people started to shout from the rooftops how good they felt. But still, we had to overcome pricing contracts from Nestle and Abbott, like take in Kate Farms. You know, we're not going to give you specialized pricing, et cetera. So there was a very uphill battle until this day. To this day, it's an uphill battle for, you know, I'm not involved day to day anymore in the operations of the company, but I brought in a gentleman that was very committed to the business, that acted almost like a founder, and he's the current CEO of the business as well.
And are you, so you're still kind of the chairman or on the board, but are you in retail now, or are you just solely focused on medical?
So to pursue my new opportunity and the final business story that I wanted to tell, which was my life story, was I started a new company recently. And to do that, I left the board of directors 11 months ago. And I'm a cheerleader of the company. They still use Katie as the face of the brand. And I'm still asked questions from time to time. And they went back into retail, sort of their number one plant-based prescribed product in the world. And now they're going back into retail, sort of like Ensure did. They were started in medical, and then they came in as the number one doctor prescribed. So we're kind of using a playbook like that.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, which many of you would not, Richard and I actually worked together with my company ProMash back in the day, 2017 or so, when you guys were doing demos in retail. And, you know, we've since expanded from demos to trade promotions and, you know, deduction management and all the crap that you probably went through. Do you think it was a relief to not be in traditional retail because you avoided the trade promotion aspects of the business? Or did you have a very similar type of occurrences in the medical field?
I think the only trade-off that I think we gained was when you're in retail, you're spending a lot on trade spend, but you're trying to become important to the consumer, whereas, and therefore the buyers take you more serious, and the it switches, right? And all of a sudden the momentum comes towards the company, and you're able to sometimes dictate terms, et cetera, et cetera. But in the beginning, when you're fighting through, that's why I tell people, don't try to be like your competition. Try to stand out like a purple cow around brown cows. And you'll learn that in my next business. I did exactly that. And that's why we're doing so well. But trade spend we spent money in a lot of other different ways. Like, for instance, in the medical world, we had to set up a massive customer service platform that cost as much as we were spending in trade spend over on the other side. The only thing is, if you could imagine a room like Expo West, just think of yourself walking in this room full of thousands of CPG companies, and think about the fact that in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and you had these really authentic farm entrepreneurs like Justin's Nut Butter and, you know, whatever, just these really, and it was just the suits weren't there, and it was a little smaller of a show, and you could make an innovation stand out and do really great. And then as soon as these fortunes started to happen, it got so competitive, and you walk in and it's like this crazy thing. Well, we pivoted in a moment where it was so hard to set up the architecture of medical, because that's why the moat of medical is the fact that the architecture between all the things you need to do to be compliant and everything you need to do there is so much more sophisticated than retail. But on the other side of things, you have very few competition. That why do you think Nestle and Abbott were the only, and Mead Johnson really a little bit, the only three people in nutrition in the entire world of medical?
Yeah.
It's because it's so hard to do all the things you needed to do. But if you can break through and put together the architecture to get it done, you have free flowing growth. And of course, our reimbursement from the government insurance was sky high because it was an innovation no one had seen before.
Love it. So what inspired the transition from a save my daughter healthy focused brand like Kate Farms to an energy drink brand, Lucky Fuck, which is, I'm assuming the name is maybe representative of your life. I don't know, but tell me a little bit about that. What facilitated that shift?
Yeah. So real quick, well, just to get the listener, we'll sort of enjoy this. You know, like people say to me all the time, oh my God, you created the legacy of this story, which is Save Your Daughter and all these people and this beautiful story. Why would you risk that for a name? Like, why would you do that? And what I say to people is, it's the same story. In other words, everyone I get presented by Forbes and all this stuff as Kate Farms was a love story, but it was an anger story. It was a rebel story. It was the guy on the beach story. It was no one giving me another chance, no one looking underneath the hood of the heart of who I was, the fact that all the struggles that I'd gone through, I was invisible in a lot of times. And so I wanted to tell the story to the consumer, the story of perseverance, of never giving up. And what I learned in the boardrooms around the world was no one's that smart. That was the first thing that just alarmed me, that, yeah, they can get a little bit better education, but we all have this ability. I think some people just give themselves permission to think they're special. Hmm. Some don't. And that none of us, the delta between what we think are the biggest geniuses in the world and ones aren't, is that some give themselves this permission to be that special. And that we're all of our IQs are within a certain period of time. So that was my first thought. The second thing was Kate Farms was born in authenticity, risk, and a gnarly story. And I felt like it just got very corporate and it just got kind of, you know, what it needs to do when companies grow up. But I wanted to tell the story of that, all of those things, traits that got me to the place that I would be the guy that never gave up. And that if I gave up and didn't create the formula, my daughter was going to die. And so therefore I was going to die. So I meant so much to win. And that the other thing, the things I shared with your listeners was that I wasn't afraid to fail. I was afraid to not try. And so what I really wanted to do is two things were going on in the energy drink category. Number one, everyone thought that it was a packed category. I thought that it was the worst. I thought it was the biggest opportunity in the history of the world, because this is why. It was very similar to dogma of the medical world that I just told you, was that you had these companies that were the biggest beverage companies in the world, and I thought none of them were great at storytelling. And number two, none of them had products that were that great. And let me just explain this to you, other than Red Bull. So RX Bar came out into a packed category in the retail world when there was almost 1,000 bars in the market. And within 3 years, they were sold to Kellogg's and they disrupted the whole thing. The founder was exactly who he presented the bar to be: uncomplicated, authentic, very few ingredients on the label. And the way he was able to do it is say, you guys are all in this race to more protein, more all this. And he went, less is more. And the consumer wanted their food from the source more, and the bar companies perhaps weren't listening to that. They were getting more and more engineered. And so I felt that the same thing was happening with Bang Energy and all these things. You had these sexy girls and you had this thing, but the storytelling would be like, if you think of Monster Energy, guy rides motocross, he goes to the store, he might buy a dip. He you know, his brand, like the storytelling that was just like, you just imagine, perhaps he was paid, perhaps he wasn't showing his product off on Instagram. So he wasn't speaking to the young generation, the monster drinker. He had Celsius, very simple. They somehow were able to own cleaner energy. And they were, girl's skinny and she eats salads. And that's just the brand. That's what you go to Red Bull, greatest company in the world, on-premise mixed cocktails. So I felt like Liquid Death was coming out. And what I loved about the founder of Liquid Death was that imagine me sitting around with you and your podcast crew and all your listeners. And I got a great idea, guys. I'm going to name the next great water brand Liquid Death. And every one of us would say, good luck with that, buddy.
Yeah.
And everyone's saying they don't like your idea. That's probably the idea that you could be onto a big, big innovation. So what I found was what I saw in me was him. We were the same people. He had an edge to him. He had a chip on his shoulder. And he sort of didn't give a, you know what. And so I saw that the young people were connecting with brands that they wanted them to be more than liquid in a bottle. They wanted them to be, to entertain them. They wanted them to sit there like rock stars and tell me a story. Tell me something that I can effing believe in. And if it's even something I disagree with, I can respect that a little bit. So from a storytelling, I wanted to tell the duality of humans that Richard Labor could be a great guy. I'm a flawed guy. I could be a disaster guy. I've had problems in life coming through the tragedies, but I've done all this, millions of meals for charity. I've done all these wonderful things, but I've got this duality. I've got all these things. And I loved when people would judge me too early and maybe they needed to get to know me more. So the idea of the brand was don't judge a book by its cover. Let's get to know the individual under the cover. Let's get to know the corporation underneath. And a cuss word is not morality. So I did know that when I came, so my son gave me a bracelet just to finish off the name. Why the name? Gave me a bracelet at Christmas 3 years ago and said, Dad, everyone thought you were the unluckiest guy in the world, but you're the lucky son. And so when I went to name the brand, I called everyone. They said, this is the worst idea. It's going to be dead on day one. I said, now I'm doing it. So I announced it to BevNet and I got all the attention and everything. And then I was able to, from there, get the respect of, so I brought over today, he started the first employee at Liquid Death, became, they crafted their entire brand, Hamid Safai. He's come over to be the CMO over here. And so really, we're going to take the F off the word. You're the first to hear this. This is coming in the next 3 weeks. It's coming off the can, but it's going to stay in our videos, our copy and everything. We understood when we started the brand we understood that 8-year-olds, downside of having F on a can, you don't want 8-year-olds or in your refrigerator. But yet again, you let your kids watch horror movies and say F words and watch sex on TV. But this is somehow when you put it on a CPG brand, like Liquid Death and Art brand. So we're gonna have a sticker, but that sticker is going to stand for censorship. And that the idea is that in most forms, censorship is very bad. But we'll take it off the can and keep everything else. We're still in 7-Eleven and AMPMs and Circle K's. We did this to start a story on. Let's open the conversation a little bit. So that's what's been going on here. We finished the seed round with Imaginary out of New York. They came to me and so we started it. Now we're talking to some pretty big players to bring the company national by the end of summer.
Good for you. And so initially, did you have a problem getting it into on shelf because the buyer's like, I'm not putting that shit on. That name's crazy. I'm not doing it.
Yeah, but it's for a different reason. It's all to what I, which is if it was the franchisee, like 7-Eleven AMPN, the guy that bought the franchisee, he has a right to take in his own products, like 30% of them. Every single one of them said yes to me. And the reason why is because they knew that it would sell. The corporate guys would say, we'll wait on you like we did Liquid Death because this is crazy, because they didn't want to lose their jobs, right? So they're in relief right now. When I call them up right now, they're like, oh my gosh, you gave us a reason to like you. We liked you, but we couldn't. So it's just happening a little bit earlier than we thought. But, you know, all this stuff is, to your podcast point, is we want people to think about their life, to be conscious of what decisions that they're making, that they're not – Their personality and who they are and what they believe in is not about being a political left or right. We've gone way too far in judging everybody and thinking that we know people. And the fact that the best people in the world are people that wear a tattoo sometimes on motorcycles, and some of the worst people I've ever seen in the world are in boardrooms that are assassins that will smile to you to your face. So I think that this broader opportunity for storytelling is incredible. And product happens to be great too.
You're definitely one to convey not to focus on the cover of the book, right? So it's really cool. So with your life journey, which is awesome, you definitely faced doubts, right? I mean, you've had in your mind that monkey brain came in and said, I'm not good enough. This won't happen. I'm going to try. I'm going to fail. Look at my life. I had issues with my parents, growing up, homeless, the whole thing. I'm sure you're probably at a higher level than most regular people with their trauma and mindset. How did you overcome your doubts through these years?
I don't think you do. I think that if you really look at any entrepreneur that tells you that they've overcome their doubts themselves, I would think is really lying to themselves. I mean, it comes down to this. The actual failure is never as bad as the preparation that we put ourselves through that could. So in other words, what I was doing in the years that Cape Farms was in the abyss and I was deluding myself and the brand was being, it was just one losing after another and people strong-arming you in contracts, is the fear that I put all this work and all my money in and for my family and the questions that you and guys like you and I go through in our head, and I guarantee Elon, I don't care who it is.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
But the actual, I failed three times before Cape Farms, and the failure, I was over it in 48 hours. It was like what we put ourselves through. It's no big deal. Like the world, you're like, oh my God, everyone's going to think I'm some failure or you're not going to get a set. It's a big story. BS.
Who cares?
Who cares? And honestly, who cares about the results of winning either? Like for instance, Andre Agassi says this all the time. It's like whether I was winning or what I was losing, it didn't define the person who I am. And all the winning does is it gives you some type of scorecard to say that you're important to in this country, which is BS to begin with. It's just a bunch of BS. What really counts is the entrepreneurs need to ask ourselves is if we're succeeding, how much have we let down? How much has this cost our family through this narcissistic, egotistical being a founder BS happened? And almost all of us can say it's cost us everything. Yeah. It costs us a lot. So that's the second time around. The fact that I got this far, and now I'm getting back to the sort of the health building blocks, which is mental health. We go through so much. I've had so many mental health issues through my founding time, which is just all the trauma of everything, the late night bar, wondering if I'm going to fail, and just people yelling at me saying you're this, that, and the other, and then your relationship, your wife is sitting right there with you and you're not present, what they go through. And then I learned through this business that I knew that if I failed, it would be okay. So I was a little less hard on myself this time. And there's a good chance I still will not make it to the other side. So what I'm trying to do is say, okay, it's time to do what we do. You know how we recover after the thing and you go and you start seeking, let's start to do that now. So like I'm doing ice baths, I'm doing almost no alcohol. We started this year. I started telling my people online I'm going to start doing this health kick. Because during the founding time, I don't know any founder that can keep it. I don't care how disciplined you are. It's hard to stay all those tenets. But like you said, to become who you were going to become, to have a really everlasting business in it. Because if you can gain all the success in the world, but if you lose yourself.
Everything, yeah.
You know, nothing, yeah. What is this? It means nothing. It's a joke. So I would rather be the guy that's self-confident in himself, that goes through the world, creating a smaller business, but makes everyone happy, than people write about you for something and fail. We've seen that too many times. I don't want to end up like that. And by the way, I have not determined, I have to tell myself every day, what am I doing to make sure I don't end up like that?
Yeah.
No money can figure.
Well, Richard, I mean, I have to get you back because I just briefly scratched the surface with the shit that you know. So, if you're good with it, one of these days we'll get you back. But I'd like to close out my interviews with the following question. Who did you have to stop being and who did you need to become to manifest your current success?
I would say... I had to stop trying to fit in. I had to make sure that I wasn't trying to please anyone, but the customer I'm serving and moving through my dream, no matter how crazy the paths looked like they were going to be, and no matter how many people told me that that's not the right path, even the biggest experts in the world, you have to go down. And I say that from a sort of, you should listen to people, but I'll say this, that what I meant by that is you'll see a lot of consultants out there, listeners, that will consult you and tell you you got to do this or you got to do that, or therapists. Yet they can't manage their own money, their own life, and have never created a beverage themselves. So you need to take the professionals for what they are. You need to keep that, but you need to listen to that inner voice. So I had to really listen to the premonition, the kid that did, got on the plane that should, you need to listen to the gut instinct. As long as you believe in your heart who you are, then you need to forget about what everyone else is saying.
I love it. How do the Seven Hatters reach out to you? I know you're busy, but
yeah.
No, how do they get in touch?
This is the biggest part of winning, by the way, is when I was on the road as a college dropout, I read 300 books. It was my only friend. No one wanted to know me. So learning through biographies and other people's stories was how I got the hope to move forward and learn that that success comes from the smallest towns in the world, the biggest colleges, the smallest colleges. Doesn't matter where you come from. Just reach out to me through, you can provide, Valeria can provide a contact to my PR. And listen, I'm available no matter what. I think the psychology of all this stuff and that we're all so damn important. And that's the lesson I hope people learn from me.
So I'll leave the, in the show notes, I'll leave ways to connect with you. Richard, you're really someone I look up to. I love your authenticity, your realness, you know, the fact that you don't give a fuck, but yet you're so soft inside. You know, you're one of those, you know, you see them, the guys with the 5 o'clock shadow and, the, you know, just the dirty clothes just walking around, but yet they're just puppies inside, you know, and just want to give love out and they want to help. And I think that's who you are. Thank you so much for gracing us on the Seven Hats. And I look forward to one day reading your book because I know it's coming. And then second, you know, potentially having you on the show again so we can dive deeper into some more trauma and some more lessons.
We'd love to be back soon. Thank you so much. And thank you to your listeners. Appreciate it.
Of course. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Richard. Let's end today with a show segment that I refer to as What Can We Hang Our Head On? And here is my takeaway. Let's take a moment to reflect on Richard's extraordinary journey and the invaluable lessons that we can learn from his remarkable story. In the tumultuous landscape of entrepreneurship, where challenges lurk around every corner, Richard's story is a testament to a great mindset, consistency, perseverance, and discipline. From surviving a harrowing plane crash to reshaping an entire industry, his journey epitomizes the resilience of the human spirit and the unwavering commitment to one's vision. Through Richard's trials and triumphs, we're reminded of the transformative power of resilience, the ability to bounce back from adversity stronger than before. It's a quality that every entrepreneur must cultivate, for success seldom comes without its fair share of setbacks. Also, Richard's story underscores the importance of unwavering determination, the relentless pursuit of one's dreams in the face of daunting obstacles. This determined persistence separates the achievers from the dreamers, propelling individuals like Richard to defy the odds and carve their own path to success. Perhaps most importantly, Richard's journey serves as a reminder that true success is not merely measured by achievements, but by the character forged in the crucible of adversity. It's about embracing challenges, learning from failures, and staying true to oneself amidst the chaos of the entrepreneurial journey. So, as we bid farewell today, let us carry Richard's story with us as a beacon of hope, a reminder that no matter how daunting the obstacles may seem, with unwavering grit, determination, and a sprinkle of audacity, we too can conquer the seemingly impossible. I want to thank Richard once again for joining me so that we can all benefit from his wisdom. And until next time, if you found this episode helpful, please hit that subscribe button and tell other entrepreneurs out there what value you received from it so that we can attract even more high-quality people into our Seven Hats community. So, for now, I will bid you farewell and success on your journey. And until next time, my name is Yuval Selick, and I tip my hat to you.